Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us online Dave Emery. We're going to be talking about, well, we'll probably be talking about a lot of fascinating things. One of them is going to be Martin Bormann. Now, for those of you who do not know, that at the end of the Second World War, when we had defeated the wicked Nazis, the OSS and later the CIA brought many of the Nazi war criminals to the United States to work on the biological experiments and space experiments and certainly psychological experiments and experiment on the American public, continuing their macabre experiments that had been carrying out in the death camps of Germany. We brought Heinrich Mueller, the head of the German Gestapo, to the United States, and Heinrich Mueller lived out his life here. We have a book on that. It's entitled The Gestapo Chief. But, of course, they couldn't let the American people know that. After all, we're told that, you know, there are certain things are true, and we're the good guys and they're the bad guys, without ever realizing that some of the same evil forces that had energized the Nazi movement were working right here in the United States. And then, of course, one of the most carefully kept secrets is the part that the OSS played, the pre-runner of the CIA played in taking and helping the Nazis, covering for the Nazis, aiding the Nazis to escape to Argentina and South America. And with that as the background, our special guest tonight, Dave Emery. Dave, thank you so much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Well, of course, I knew Mae Brussel years and years ago, I guess 25, 30 years ago, we talked a few times, and Mae was really the forerunner of so many of the conservative talk show commentators, and then, of course, when Mae passed away, why, Dave picked up the mantle from her and has continued informing people with his vast array of knowledge about the information you're not going to get through regular channels. So we were going to talk tonight about Martin Bormann.
Sure. I think even more importantly than Martin Bormann, the organization that he really continued, because in fact, and by the way, the introduction that you gave to so many of these facts was a very good one. And I think perhaps by way of supplementing what you said, when so many of these Nazis were brought over to the United States, and when they began continuing their work, they were doing so as part of a Third Reich that had gone underground and had perpetuated itself in mafia-like fashion. And Dr. Stan, I'm going to ask that you sort of be like a batting coach or a pitching coach for the presentation that we're doing here, because so many of the things that I'm going to talk about are well-known to myself as a specialist, and yet not necessarily that well known to the audience. So I'm going to ask you sort of to be like a batting coach or a pitching coach, or perhaps we could conceive of what I'm going to try to do as like flying a blimp or an air balloon of some kind, and I'm going to ask that you help to keep me moored, so to speak, to the bedrock of general popular opinion here, because if I get too far into a particular subject matter, if what I'm talking about isn't clear, then I'm going to ask it that you know, interrupt me with a question or remind me or develop a point very much further. But in terms of talking about Martin Bormann, in terms of understanding what is assailing the world today, I think that it's important for us to understand that the events that you described, Stan, and some other things that supplement that, were really part of a Third Reich that had gone underground and that was exploiting many of the forces that were loose in the world at that time and forces that bear upon our present situation in order to perpetuate themselves. And I think in terms of understanding some of those forces, first of all, tremendous economic power, which was available to the Bormann organization, and that really goes back to the end of World War I. In the U.S., President Teddy Roosevelt had instituted the trust-busting program. This kept giant industries from completely monopolizing a particular area of American economic production. Standard Oil was probably the best known of the old trusts. They dominated the oil business, and the U.S. passed laws to prevent that. But there was a loophole, the Webb-Parmalee Act, which permitted the same kinds of activities abroad on the part of American financiers and industrialists that had been made illegal in the United States. So at the end of World War I, the U.S. experienced a tremendous economic boom driven by radio and by the automobile and the newfound intellectual and media and physical mobility that those provided. But the profits from that boom were not invested in the American industrial and financial infrastructure. That's one of the reasons why we had the Great Depression. The only way capitalism can work is for capital to be invested and generated in such a way as that it invested in such a way as it generates more capital. It's like an industrial system.
That wasn't part of this, of course, related to the Federal Reserve System, because now we could massively expand the currency, although, of course, we supposedly had the anchor of gold. Still, the Federal Reserve System allowed the central bankers, because that's what the Federal Reserve System is, have nothing to do with the federal government. It's a privately owned central bank. And now they could begin to expand the monetary system. And so you could really begin to create this artificial prosperity, and the people of great wealth could go out and borrow the money and invest it. And that really created the Roaring Twenties. And things seemed like they would never end. We had a new economy, as it were, was back there in 1926 and 27 and 28.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, many of the same catchphrases were used back in the 1920s. This is a new economy, and that the old cautions about investing and speculating were no longer accurate. And in fact, near the end of the speculative bubble in the 1990s and going into 2000, I remember reading any number of op-ed columns where people were cautioning that, hey, you know, in the 1920s, people said the same thing. But in terms of understanding what's going on today, it's worth understanding that when Hitler conquered Europe, when the Japanese swept over Asia, assisted by Benito Mussolini, this wasn't some kind of happenstance, but rather the tremendous military and industrial power which Nazi Germany and also the Japanese and to a lesser extent the Italians utilized to sweep over much of civilization was in fact the transmuted economic power of the American industrial boom of the 1920s. Powerful industrialists and financiers grouped largely around the House of Morgan, not only the J.P. Morgan Bank, but also the DuPonts, the Rockefellers, and others, invested in fascist Italy. They invested in pre-Hitler Germany, and they invested in Imperial Japan, and got tremendous profits from their investments. And one of the reasons we had the Depression was that instead of investing money in the American infrastructure, it was invested abroad. And so that ultimately the collapse of the American capital markets and the failure to sustain the American economy were due to the fact that American investors and financiers were investing in the fascist powers that manifested themselves in World War II. Now, in terms of how this relates to Martin Bormann, how this relates to post-war events, in terms of understanding what I guess would seem to many listeners as sort of a James Bondish or a Boys from Brazil kind of scenario, it's worth understanding, I think, the economic forces involved. Not only was Hitler financed largely by cartels, which were inextricably linked with the most powerful names of Wall Street finance and industry, the Bush family, by the way, being among those. But the economic power that was gleaned by the Third Reich as a result, first of all, of the fact that the profits from the American industrial boom of the 1920s were invested in Italy and Japan and Germany, not in the United States. Then when the Nazis conquered Europe, they mobilized all of the liquid wealth in Europe for their own purposes. There's a very credible estimate by British intelligence of the amount of money that was secreted out of Europe from the occupied countries. And this is minus what they took from the Soviet, what the Third Reich, I should say, took from the Soviet Union and Greece. But it was estimated at $143 billion in early 1940s dollars. And that's an incalculable sum of money, probably greater than the U.S. national debt today. Then, after the Third Reich had secreted its wealth abroad using the 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries, they then basically began playing a very interesting game. The Third Reich went underground. It didn't disappear. But some of them hooked up with the former Soviet Union, and even more of them hooked up with their old financiers and their old compatriots in the United States and Britain and some of the other Western countries. And it basically began playing both sides against the middle. There was an outright Nazi organization in the Federal Republic of Germany called the Socialist Reichsparty, or SRP, that was used to try to mobilize Western public opinion on behalf of Germany, and beyond that to help to form some of these relationships between the United States and the residua of Nazi Germany under the threat that, well, if they didn't, then Germany might go communist.
Yeah, because that is really so what's interesting, Dave, is they always use the threat of communism. Now, I'm not belittling the fact that communism is a threat. I am belittling the fact that, or pointing out the fact that we have financed communism. We financed it before the Second World War, during the Second World War, after the Second World War. We even gave the plates to the American occupation currency to the Russians so that they could print up our money, we would redeem it, and they could finance their troops. In Eastern Europe, we even offered to give them the Marshall Plan, which would already offer to Western Germany or Western Europe to counter the threat of communism. We offered it to the communists. They didn't take it, but we continued subsidizing them, creating the best enemy money could buy, and that then would be used to justify our financing of Germany, and of course our help to the Nazis, and even bringing people like Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, to America, because he could help us fight the communists who would create it and fund it from their very inception.
The story of American capital and what was done is a very complex one, and I think that it's very important to understand that anti-communism was something that was utilized in a very cynical fashion by fascist elements both in the United States and elsewhere. I think the German component of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we're talking about was considerably cagier than many of their counterparts in the United States. And I think that what has happened is that utilizing not only the tremendous economic power, and again, when we talk about the Bormann Organization, we're talking about something that is linked to the most powerful elements of the American power elite, the elements that financed Hitler and Mussolini and fascist Japan in the first place are not peripheral elements. You're talking about elements like General Motors, elements like the Rockefeller family, elements like the old Standard Oil Trust, the DuPonts. One of Hitler's three earliest and most prominent financial backers was George Herbert Walker, who is George W. Bush's great-grandfather and whose last name George W. Bush carries as a middle name. And one of the key people involved with investing money on behalf of the Bush family in Nazi infrastructure, pre-Nazi and Nazi infrastructure, was Alan Dulles. You mentioned the OSS span. Well, Alan Dulles was one of the principal operatives of the Office of Strategic Services. He later went on to become director of the CIA at the same time as his brother John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. Now, earlier, both Dulles brothers had worked for a very powerful Wall Street law firm called Sullivan and Cromwell. And in that regard, they made investments in Nazi Germany on behalf of the Bush family and many other prominent families in the United States as well. And these profound economic relationships were basically perpetuated into the post-war period. And in turn, the threat of communism was utilized, and I think it was utilized very skillfully, both in the United States by political manipulators here, and in particular, very skillfully by the Third Reich, at the same time as this underground Reich was also saying to the Soviets and to communists elsewhere, in particular they formed alliances with the communist Chinese and other elements, they were saying, look, we have more in common with each other than we do with these bourgeois American imperialists with their chewing gum and Coca-Cola culture and their pornography and everything else. So they were able to play both sides against the middle, and what, in my opinion, had been a junior partner in these activities ultimately became the senior partner. Now let's take a look at two elements of the Bormann group. First of all, Martin Bormann himself was he carried the formal term of Reichsleiter in the Third Reich. He was basically the power behind the throne, and he was formally named to succeed Adolf Hitler as the head of the NSDAP, the Nazi Party in Germany. Now, Stan, you brought up a very important name, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, and someone who, like Martin Bormann, was supposed to have died at the end of World War II. But in fact, Heinrich Müller, who, as of the early 1980s, continued to hold the title of Reich Minister of the Interior in exile, controlled the political and intelligence apparatus of the SS. And that, in turn, was inextricably linked with the American CIA and with intelligence services in other countries, due to the actions of people like Alan Dulles and others. End of World War II, the U.S. did not have an intelligence capability in Russia and Eastern Europe. So what we did is we took in an organization called Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East. Now, this was the Third Reich's intelligence services for the Eastern Front in World War II. It was headed up by a guy named General Reinhard Gehlen. And basically, Gehlen, his entire organization, basically Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization and our entire eyes and ears on the Soviet Union in the Cold War period, came directly from Adolf Hitler. And his top intelligence chief, Reinhard Gehlen, was flown into the United States in the uniform of a four-star general, was given the pay of a four-star general. This was in July of 44. This was even before the guns fell silent in the Pacific. And basically, Gehlen, his entire organization, which in turn incorporated the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground, was grafted onto the fledgling U.S. Intelligence apparatus. And in turn, that tremendous political and military power, because intelligence functions are obviously a very important part of the military, can be thought of as being one component of a Third Reich that went underground and which at the same time maintained these very, very important political and economic relationships with people like the Dulles brothers and people affiliated with the power elite that is manifesting itself today. So
I think one of the most fascinating things, you know, I've studied these goings-on for the better part of 41 years, and it wasn't until really within the last 6 to 9 months that I was aware that Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, the Gestapo chief, was brought to the United States by the CIA and given a fat job and then allowed to retire comfortably and live out his life up there in Piedmont. There was a force behind him. How could you conceal that from the American people and from researchers? Why, you have to have almost total control over what the American people think. And as I say, we do carry a book, one based upon Heinrich Müller's diaries, another simply The Gestapo Chief, the story of Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, who is well rewarded for his services. I came to America, had a nice, comfortable job, and nobody in America ever heard. We'll be right back here with Dave Emery. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dave Emery, and he's giving us an overview of so much of what really went on behind the scenes. When I went through Colonel House's papers back at Yale University, the Sterling Library, in about 1980-81, I came across a letter that had been written by the American ambassador to Germany at that time. This was 1936. He was writing to Colonel Edward Mandel House, and incidentally a copy of that letter is contained in our syllabus entitled Iraq, the Untold Story. And of course, in that letter, American ambassador to Germany is writing to Colonel House and saying, why are American corporations building up the war-making ability of the Nazis? We just got through with a war over here. Nobody wants another war. It's 1936. We're just recovering from the last war. Why are American corporations building up the Nazi war-making material or the German war-making effort when they can't make any money on it? There's exchange controls. They can't get any money out of the country. Do the stockholders back at home realize what's happening, that they're building up the military over here and there's not going to be any profit made? Well, of course, you know, the average American would find that difficult to believe. We have the letter. We'd be glad to make a copy available to anybody out there in the listening audience. If you call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But you have to understand these things are real. They went on. And certainly Professor Sutton's excellent book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, is simply the tip of the iceberg. So many other books that are available, and the documentation, I'm sure, that Dave has. So you go ahead and with the story, Dave.
All righty. Well, I'm going to, and again, I'm going to rely on you as sort of the pitching coach or the batting coach here, or perhaps extending the metaphor, perhaps the foundation for this particular airship here, because it's not the easiest thing in the world for me to make some of these points clear to an audience, and with this is not in any way to be self-righteous or judgmental, but that may not be familiar with some of the facts concerning these things. Now, at the end of World War II, I'm using the term here, meaning the United States, we're in a position where there was this global conflict, which in turn had been engendered to a certain extent by a lot of the lack of wisdom that existed collectively in the world, and a Third Reich which had gone underground and perpetuated itself very much like the mafia. In other words, Dr. Stan, you've heard about the Italian mafia or the Sicilian mafia or the Chinese mafia or the Russian mafia. But have you ever heard of the German mafia?
Well, we don't talk about it until you begin getting into Operation Paperclip and the things you're talking about, and then you suddenly realize that both here in the United States and in South America, why this entity continued, and of course, so much of this money was transferred, you know, by the Swiss banks, you know, and allowed, of course, to get to South America with the help of the OSS, and of course, who was the OSS chief there in Switzerland? Why was a man named
Alan Dulles.
Alan Dulles, right.
Absolutely. Now, earlier, of course, Alan Dulles, as a key lawyer for Sullivan and Cromwell, along with his brother John Foster Dulles, had helped to set up the Dawes and Young plan through which American investments were made in pre-Nazi Germany and also in fascist Italy. And it's worth understanding that the corporations, which in turn were funded by Wall Street, then set up Adolf Hitler as their top boy. And so what you had was this remarkable state of affairs in which some people who had helped to build the hand...
We're going to be right back here in just a moment with Dave Emery. All right, fine. Well, I guess is Dave Emery, and he's just talking about how American corporations and American banks actually helped to create the best enemy our money could buy by financing Benito Mussolini, by financing Adolf Hitler, and now we're ready for a second great world war.
Indeed, and I think if one were to take a good long look at some of the things that are going on, I think we can perhaps understand that we've been manipulated into this situation, and I think that the manipulators, so to speak, were themselves victims on the one hand of their own lack of insight or foresight, and also of simply The greed that potentially threatens, I think, most people if they let their own desires get out of hand. What I'd like to do, perhaps, Dr. Stan, would be to maybe engage in a little bit of whole seminarism or a little bit of a sort of do-it-yourself sing-along type of broadcasting. When I started doing radio, no tool like the Internet existed. And, of course, now it does. And given the complexity of so many of the things that I talk about, and given the fact that a lot of them just aren't generally known to people, what I've been doing for quite some time is putting together a website which does in print what I've been doing on the radio. My program that is distributed to a number of stations consists of me reading from documentary sources, and in turn, I've taken many of those and put those online. And the website is spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. And if listeners who are in a position to do this physically would like to do this, fire up your computers, get up spitfirelist.com, and perhaps as we attempt to navigate through some of these historical and political and economic realities. And again, Stan, Dr. Stan, I'm going to leave the executive judgment here up to you, and I'm going to request and insist that you sort of act as our moor here, because it may be that in terms of discussion, we'll range a little bit too far afield. But what I want to stress so strongly to listeners is that the documentation for these things exists. And in the end, I would absolutely insist that whatever people feel about the presentation that they're hearing this evening, that they withhold judgment until they've had a chance to examine some of the facts for themselves. And I also want to hold out both to you, Dr. Stan, and to members of your audience the fact that I don't get paid for my work. This is a labor of love or duty. A lot of people ask, why are you doing this? Well, I started out on the air some 24 years ago in very much the same spirit as Paul Revere took his midnight ride. And that'll perhaps sound a little corny or maybe a little self-righteous. If so, I will ask listeners' forgiveness and indulgence in advance. But, when Paul Revere started out on his midnight ride, he wasn't thinking about syndication rights or royalties. He wasn't thinking about copyrights. And I've proceeded in a similar fashion. And at SpitfireList.com, I've not only got a body of information available for free for the use of whoever wants to use it, but in particular for the last 3 years or so, I've been taking the time to put the information from the source material on the website and on the descriptions. Now, for example, we were talking about the U.S. investing in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. Well, if we scroll down on the website, we can come to For the Record 361, which I call networking. Dr. Stan, a lot of people, when they hear about this type of material, they go, oh, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. And indeed, that's sort of a mantra almost that is invoked by the media and by political scientists when they really don't want to deal with some sticky issues. And yet there's so much information that's publicly available. The term conspiracy theory makes us run for the exits. But if we think of a different word, if we use the term networking, well, gee, that's what yuppies do. That's what people do all over the world. So that, I think, is a more useful term. And, for example, in For the Record 361, I've reproduced the documentation about some of this networking, which I think is a better buzzword than conspiracy theory. Well, I talk about names like Sullivan and Cromwell, and talking about some of the many bases on which that law firm touched. By the way, today, if we scroll down to paragraph 2 of the description for FTR 361 at spitfirelist.com, and I'll just read directly from the website.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, because we got to go to a break.
Okie doke.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and of course he's well known in circles as far as the documentation he's able to amass, and of course you can go to his website at spitfirelist.com. Of course, let me mention that so much of what he's talking about, we're well aware with. If you want to get into the background of the bringing of the Nazis to the United States, of course, that's contained in a book called A Secret Agenda by Linda Hunt. Now, an interesting study in trying to get hold of that book, try to get hold of Linda Hunt's Secret Agenda. I just bought, or one of my our listeners bought a copy for me for $130. It was published in 1990-1991 by St. Martin's Press, a limited distribution. And, of course, this goes into the background of Operation Paperclip and how certainly the CIA and the OSS brought the Nazis to the United States and, of course, helped them escape to South America. Why would we do that? Oh, we had to get them out of Germany. Otherwise, the wicked communists would have captured them and put them to work and, of course, then began to utilize their information on space and the other macabre experiments they'd done against us. So they allowed people like Dr. Mengele, the Angel of Death, who had killed so many people in the concentration camps, and of course, Eichmann, and you can go down the list of all of the people we allowed to escape to South America, because, and most of these people, of course, the communists probably would have put into prison, but we helped them to escape to South America where they could live and live very comfortably. Now, the books that we have available through our ministry, books like The Medusa File, Operation Bluebird, I think is the title to it, goes into, covers much of the same material, but The Medusa File and Bluebird certainly give you a great deal of insight into this very tragic episode in our history. The Gestapo chief, Heinrich Mueller's diaries, the Mueller diaries. How would you possibly be able to do something like this and keep it from the American people? Well, you would have to control all the major media outlets. You would have to control our universities. You would have to control the pulpits of America. You would have to control really exactly what the American people think. And until the American people understand that all of those things have been accomplished, the pulpits are quiet. They don't want to talk about anything because so many ministers have far more fear of government than they have of God. The universities are subsidized. If you are a conservative, pro-American, libertarian on a college campus today, why, you'll probably get your tires slashed. And, of course, if you are try to tell the truth in the media, you'll end up like Christina Borgensen or so many others have, Gary Webb and others who've tried to tell the truth. We'll be right back here in just a moment, and we even have a book called Into the Buzzsaw by Christina Borgensen that tells what happened to her and 17 of her cohorts, one of them a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer who now can't get a job anywhere in the media. What was his crime? He tried to tell the truth about the CIA's involvement in drug smuggling as one of the major drug smuggler in America. But we can't let the American people know that. After all, we have a war on drugs, don't we? Well, Dave, go ahead and pick up the story from there. But they can get the material off of your website. We can verify it with many of the books that we have through our ministry. And the two of them together, I think you're going to get quite an education. Go ahead.
All righty. Well, I just can't encourage people strongly enough to basically take advantage, you know, of what's available. And I'll extend to you, Dr. Stan, the offer, as I've extended to all people, to, you know, use the website as the Spitfire website as a vehicle for accessing other sources. And then here, for example, there's a wonderful book that was put out. I think the title kind of killed it. It was put out by a former government investigator in this country and a professional military officer who in turn acts as the attorney for a number of whistleblowers within the U.S., British, Israeli, and Soviet, former Soviet secret services. And it's a guy named John Loftus, who's done some great work in connection with September 11th. He wrote a great book called The Secret War Against the Jews, wrote another great book called Unholy Trinity about some of the Paperclip and Galen people who worked with the Vatican, and originally wrote The Belarus Secret about the importation of some of these Nazis to work for the U.S. intelligence service. But to give you listeners, and maybe Dr. Stan, what I'm about to say will be a little bit confusing, so I'm going to rely on your editorial expertise in this regard, but to give people an idea of the extent to which some of these relationships extend backward in time and forward, reading now from, and again on the Spitfire website, FTR 361, networking, which I think is a more useful term than conspiracy theory when trying to relate this information to a listener. If you say conspiracy theory, people automatically react, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I don't want to think about that, and I don't have to think about it because it has no legitimacy. But if you use the term networking, oh, you mean what I do? Well, if we skip down in 361, and this is in paragraph 2, and I'm just going to read directly from the text on my own website here. The broadcast begins by highlighting the fact that legal advice to the Bin Laden construction firm is provided by the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, and quoting directly from the book Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden by Peter Bergen. Furthermore, the family company, that Saudi Bin Laden Group, maintained a satellite office in Maryland during the 1990s, employs a public relations agency in Manhattan, and receives legal advice from the White Shoe law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And by the way, this passage, Dr. Stan, highlights one of the reasons why we don't hear a whole lot about a lot of these things, and that is that big money can buy lawyers, first of all, to threaten lawsuits against people, and beyond that, it can hire public relations firms, and beyond that, it can hire, it can create nonprofit foundations, which in turn can be used to underwrite many of the academic and media opinions that are disseminated to people. So this is one of the ways in which political control is maintained. But now, we hear a lot about Saudi Arabia today, and this is in connection with Al-Qaeda, with Osama bin Laden. There are, in fact, strong evidentiary tributaries which run from Saudi Arabia to Sullivan and Cromwell, to some of the Bush family connections, and indeed the Bush family has very strong business connections with people like the bin Ladens, with the Saudi power elite. And these things, too, go back to the period immediately after World War I. Now, reading now from FTR 361, and reading about the very same period that we were talking about earlier, Dr. Stan, the period right after World War I, where we have Wall Street capital being invested in Mussolini, in pre-Hitler Germany. Those same corporations helped to fund Nazis. And also, the same thing took place in Japan at the same time. Reading from paragraph 3 from the Spitfire website, and I'm hoping that listeners have their computers fired up and can read right along with me and bookmark some of this stuff. What I'm talking about in this, on this website, or in this part of the website, next, the broadcast reviews some of the networking that has occurred among the House of Saud, the Third Reich, the Dulles brothers, principal operators in Sullivan and Cromwell, and British spy and Nazi agent Jack Philby. By the way, he was the father of the very famous British intelligence and KGB double, Kim Philby. And reading now from the text, this period stretching from the end of World War I to just after the end of World War II was characterized by three very evil men. And by the way, the author here is talking about Saudi Arabia. Jack Philby, a British spy, Ibn Saud, his Arab protege, and Alan Dulles, an American spy and Wall Street lawyer specializing in international finance. The racist nature of their secret war against Zionism does not appear in the history books for a simple reason. Jack Philby later was paid by Western oil companies to write pro-Arab propaganda disguised as history. Ibn Saud is best remembered as the glorious Arab leader who unified Saudi Arabia and led the richest oil region in the world into partnership with the West. Philby, if he is remembered at all, has the reputation of a scholarly British Arabist overshadowed by his son Kim, the infamous Soviet double agent.
Now, who are you quoting here?
I'm quoting John Loftus from
The Secret War Against the Jews. Yes, excellent, excellent book.
And this is right from the website, and for the record, 361.
All right.
And I'm going to try to tie this up with some of the events that we've just been talking about. And by the way, this is a vista, Dr. Stan, that opens up on the functional equivalent of infinity, because these things go forward in time through the Al-Qaeda, Al-Taqwa network, something a lot of people haven't heard about, Lugano, Switzerland, which is the epicenter for the bank Al-Taqwa. It also is the epicenter of the Thyssen Bornemisza Economic Empire, which has as its main manifestation the ThyssenKrupp firm today. Thyssen is a heavy industrial firm which merged with the famous Krupp arms manufacturers that had armed Germany for hundreds of years. And it is from the Thyssen-Bornemisza industrial empire that the Bush family derives much of their original economic expertise. But now back to Saudi Arabia, and again, maybe I'm trying to tie in too much here, too fast for the audience. If so, Stan, don't hesitate to jump in and try to ground me a little bit here, so that we can keep this cogent for members of the audience. But looking at how some of the relationships manifesting today stem from these same types of phenomena. Jack Philby has become an obscure footnote to the history of the Cold War, but his legacy was far from minor. He is one of the lesser-known but most influential persons in the modern history of the Middle East, the renegade British intelligence agent who plucked an obscure terrorist out of the desert and helped to make him the king of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud was very much his creation. Philby stole the information from British intelligence files that engineered Saudi control over the holiest shrines of the Muslim world. Jack Philby and Ibn Saud betrayed the British Empire and made the American oil companies economic masters of that region. The man who helped them do it was Alan Dulles, an American spy who had befriended Philby while he was coordinating American intelligence in the Middle East in the first half of the 1920s. Between them, these three men built the very foundations of the modern Middle East. They were the architects of the oil weapon, the instigators of war, the manipulators of history. More important, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Alan Dulles' profits came from the same source. I then go in to tie that in this discussion back in with the formation of the capitalizing of Hitler and Mussolini, something we spoke about earlier, Dr. Stan. And if I could ask listeners to scroll up on the website, those who have been able to get their computers going, if we go up, scrolling up on the SpitfireList.com website, FTR 233 and on, and I've taken much of the meat of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and if we click on For the Record 305, I put much of that documentation directly from the text into the description for 305, so that if there are some listeners out there who are scratching their heads or wondering, you know, gee, it sounds interesting, but where can I find out more? I put the meat of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, online in For the Record 305. And I've also taken the professional biography of Paul Manning, a very heroic American journalist who broke the story about the economic implications of the Bormann Organization. And I put his professional biography on the web as well, in a description called About Paul Manning. And it describes his World War II journalistic history. Paul Manning, to make a long story short, was part of the CBS News team that covered World War II under Edward R. Murrow. Paul Manning trained as a gunner aboard American bombing aircraft so that he could cover the air raids over Western Europe, because listeners will recall that the planes were not in a position to take journalists, or they weren't in a position to take dead weight, because they basically were limited on these long-distance bombing missions. And Paul Manning actually trained as a gunner aboard American bombing aircraft to cover the American bombing raids over World War II, over Europe in World War II. He was almost killed in that regard. He then broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network, and then, rather than resting on his laurels, he trained as a gunner on a B-29 so that he could cover the American air raids over Japan in World War II, and then broadcast the surrender of Japan on the CBS radio network from the deck of the USS Missouri, and was the only broadcast journalist to broadcast both of the surrenders on the CBS radio network. And his incredible account, not only of his own journalistic experiences, but in covering the Bormann Organization and suffering greatly. This, by the way, Dr. Stan, was one of the greatest maybe the greatest broadcast journalist of his generation, and a very brave one, and yet, because of the economic power of the Bormann organization, the family was never even able to own their own home, because they were just destroyed by the tremendous economic power that was ranged against them. And later, Paul Manning, that is, was going to publish a follow-up to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and his son Jerry was killed. And I suspect that was out of retribution, the dedication to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. I'm just going to scroll down and see if I can find this passage here. Yeah, here we go. Scrolling down in the description about Paul Manning. Manning paid dearly for his efforts. He was actively marginalized. He was actively marginalized, and his family suffered the resultant economic hardship. And for the record, 145, I actually read from some of Paul Manning's correspondence with professional colleagues about his experiences. And in For the Record 152, I relate Paul Manning's account of how his career was destroyed. And skipping down in this description, eventually Paul's son Jerry was murdered in retribution for the Bormann research and as a warning against publishing a follow-up volume in search of Martin Bormann.
Well, I think it's so important our listeners understand that Bormann is sort of the head of the Nazi movement in South America, and they're into Argentina, they're into Chile, they're into Paraguay, aviation specialists are in Brazil, and they laid the basis for the Brazilian aviation industry, which today really is a very effective. Many of these smaller passenger planes, even used here in the United States, are manufactured in Brazil, and all an end result, of course, of the Nazi influence in South America. But of course, they were able to control the governments down there because of their influence. Perón and his wife, I believe, was Eva. But they were just thugs. They were fascist leaders, and yet, of course, because of the influence of the Nazis there and their ability to influence the media here in the United States, Perón came out as a great hero. And of course, here are these Nazis who should have been tried and convicted for their war crimes. The only one they ever got out was Adolf Eichmann, and it wasn't because the OSS or the CIA or the righteous American administrations went there to get them. It was the Nazi hunters from the Simon Wiesenthal Center that were there to track down at least Eichmann, but the rest of them got off scot-free. And that is the most incredible part of this story, and the average American doesn't understand that the same spiritual and economic interests were at work here that were at work in Germany and in South America. And it all ties together when you begin to understand, as I write in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, it all really ties together. You must see how it all interconnects. So Dave is doing a great job of getting the information together. Go ahead.
And I'm just going to skip up now into the description. I just your thought keyed. I was going to read the description from the dedication to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And what Paul Manning did was to dedicate it to his four sons and his wife Peg, whose constant inspiration and encouragement convinced him to go ahead and publish his book. Well, I guess the underground Reich, as I call it, one should imagine, again, a Third Reich that simply went underground at the end of World War II, utilizing its powerful economic and political connections and also its intelligence expertise through the deadly General Mueller. And this enabled these relationships of power to be perpetuated, because, again, it'll seem crazy to people, maybe, if I'm talking about a Third Reich that went underground. People can accept the notion that the Mafia has perpetuated itself in a very effective, very deadly, ongoing, and yet clandestine fashion. The movie The Godfather, for example, that begins at the end of World War II. Well, from a practical standpoint, in looking at the development of the underground Reich, we could think of something very similar having happened in the modern world, and that when we look at General Mueller or General Galen or the Project Paperclip scientists or Martin Bormann, it's important that we understand that it's not just taking a bunch of evil people and using them as hired guns. That would be bad enough. But rather, this was actually an element of a Third Reich that went underground and that had it had the greatest concentration of economic power under a single control in world history. And I'll just read very, very briefly a paragraph from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and Dr. Stan was talking about the relationship between Juan Perón in Argentina and Martin Bormann. Well, in fact, these relationships are well documented. I'm just going to scrolling down in For the Record 305, and I'm looking for a passage that I must have skipped past it, but it there's a discussion of the banking connections that Martin Bormann had to Juan Perón, and I'm improvising a little bit here for the benefit of the listening audience, but it's quite remarkable when one examines the documentation. And at one point, from page 205 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, from the FBI file on Martin Bormann. And this, again, this isn't some fly-by-night thing, but this is from the FBI file on Martin Bormann, quote, and quoting from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning's book, the file revealed that he had been banking, he is Martin Bormann, the file revealed that he had been banking under his own name in New York for some time. Quote, the file revealed that he had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941. That he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th, 1967, had written checks on demand in First National City Bank, Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. And you were talking about the arrest of Adolf Eichmann, Dr. Stan, and his subsequent trial in Germany. One of the things that keeps people...
You're doing great. I shouldn't even mention that. But
no, well, it's important, and because as I said, my concern going into the broadcast was that I wouldn't be able to sufficiently ground some of this discussion for the members of the audience. But you're doing a good job, and you're helping me to stay within the context that I think the listeners can understand here. Also, the listeners should understand I'm following along right from the Spitfire website here, and that all of this documentation is reproduced for the reference and use of all the members and participants of this broadcast. We were talking about Adolf Eichmann, and one of the things that keeps people quiet, in addition to the tremendous economic power that is available, and lawyers can sue people, PR firms can deceive things, and beyond that, I think one of the reasons why a lot of these conspiratorial processes go forward is that people will join an organization, whether it's a business firm, a law firm, they've joined the FBI, the CIA, the military, or whatever, and they go along and they've got a career, and then maybe 10, 15 years in, they discover something terribly wrong, something of great illegality, something that is terribly wrong from a moral standpoint, and which would implicate their employer in a big way, in an institutional way. Well, then they've got the choice of blowing the whistle or perhaps throwing their life away, throwing their life away professionally, because at this point they got a mortgage, they've got car payments, they're saving for their kids' college education, and if they blow the whistle, whether on a corporation, a law firm, or whatever, they aren't going to continue. But Dr. Stan, you mentioned the trial of Adolf Eichmann, and quoting again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Israeli agents who move too closely to these centers of power are eliminated. And this is paragraph 39 of the description for FTR 305 from the Spitfire List website. Spitfirelist.com, I should say. Israeli agents who move too closely to these centers of power are eliminated. One such termination was Fritz Bauer, former attorney general for the state of Hesse in Frankfurt, a survivor of Auschwitz and the man who tipped off the Israeli Mossad about the presence of Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires, who was killed on orders of General Mueller. Euler's ruthlessness, even today, is what deters Arthur Oxmann from altering his testimony that he saw Bormann lying dead on the roadway the night of their escape from the Führer bunker, May 1st and 2nd, 1945. To this day, Oxmann, the only so-called living witness to the, quote, death, unquote, of Bormann in Berlin, knows his life is in jeopardy if he reverses himself. General Mueller is thorough and has a long memory, and for a Nazi such as Oxmann to go against Mueller's original directive would make him a traitor. Retribution would surely follow.
So now, of course, what year is this being written?
This book was published in 1981.
Now, remember, of course, at that time, Heinrich Mueller was on the CIA payroll here in the United States. Perhaps he'd retired on his fat pension. He, I think, died in about 1985. He was living in Berkeley in California. How would you conceal something like that from the American people, that here is this man operating out of Germany, pardon me, operating out of Berkeley, employed by the CIA, who is directing this whole network of Nazi murderers and assassins? It is a strange thing that could be kept secret. I will have to admit I was suddenly very humbled when I suddenly realized I had no idea about this aspect of history, even though I've dedicated the last 41 years to its study. So obviously Dave is one ahead of me, was well aware of this, I'm sure, many years ago. So there's so many aspects of this whole conspiracy. That's why an opportunity to spend some time with Dave this evening and, of course, get the benefit of his study really is, I think, well worthwhile, not only for myself but for our listening audience. Well, we're going to have to let our listeners up there in the great Northwest go. Of course, this is the end of the week, so we won't be with you again until next Monday. But, of course, this is the time I want to remind our listeners and the four or five stations up there in eastern Washington that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you believe there's a problem, if you'd like to join us in this epic struggle to try to use the airwaves to reach people across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story, why, seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you can do that simply by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, go to Dave's website, spitfirelist.com. Go to my website, radioliberty.com. Why, you can actually listen to my programs 5 hours a day there on the Internet. You won't get anything accomplished if you do, but you can link to our other networks we're on. You can listen to our archive programs. You can listen to this program for several weeks. We give you our permission to pull it down off the Internet and make copies and try to get other people to listen. If you find what we're saying is just too incredible, try to track down some of the books. Try to get a copy of Linda Hunt's Secret Agenda and find out how expensive this small little book, I was able to read it in one afternoon, would be, $130. But you see, a lot of these books are simply bought up and shredded. They're very, very hard to get. And there is an organized effort to control exactly what the American people think. So this is the time when, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival in America, because if the American people don't turn back to their religious roots, why, I do not believe that God will ever again look with favor on America. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, and this is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But I'm going to ask you to hold your calls until the last 15 minutes of this program because there's just so much information that I want to get and I hope that you do as well. And sometimes calls can be distracting. Now that's ordinarily not the case. We love to take calls, but for this very, very special program, I'm going to ask you to hold your calls, and we'll, of course, put out an announcement there towards the end of the program, if we do want calls. But in the meantime, our guest is Dave Emery. His website is spitfirelist.com, and I hope you're enjoying the program as much as I am. David, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story from there?
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Stan, and once again, I want to thank you for having me on, and I want to thank the listeners for putting up with what I'm sure is a very pedantic, hopefully not a too pedantic, format. And once again, in our second half of our broadcast, Stan, Dr. Stan, I'm going to ask you to sort of act as my ground here. And if at any point I'm getting a little too far afield, if some of the things that I'm saying are unclear in the context that I'm trying to present them, well, I'm just going to ask you to kind of pull me back and we'll try to place this in a context that would be maybe easier for some listeners to understand. Now, again, in the on the SpitfireList.com website, I'm scrolling down to item number 47 in the description for the record 305, and in that file, I've distilled the meat of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, written by one of the really great and heroic journalists in American history, the late Paul Manning.
I assume that book is no longer available.
You could find it, I'm sure, on various websites. It's no longer in print, but it is still available.
All right, fine. We'll see if we can get a copy. Go ahead.
Okay, it would be a worthwhile thing to do. I think they charge a lot of money for it now. I've heard people saying that it was going for outrageous sums of money. But if you do, if you look on Amazon or on Barnes & Noble or one of the online internet book availability services, I'm sure it's still available. Probably asking a pretty stiff price for it, though. And it was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, and it's copyrighted 1981 by the Manning family. And in one of the closing sections of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning discusses the Bormann financial network as the reality of a Third Reich gone underground. And reading from paragraph 47, or section 47, from For the Record 305, that's FTR 305, and listeners are invited to read right along with me here. And once again, I want to stress the reason why this is such a pedantic arrangement is I wouldn't expect anybody to take my word for any of this. It's too important, it's too scary, frankly, and it's also something that is so far from what people are accustomed to thinking about that I think it's imperative that somebody present the documentation that they're utilizing. The Bormann Group, and reading from paragraph 47, the Bormann Group maintains effective control over the modern German economy. Atop an organizational, quoting now from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders and significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he, meaning Martin Bormann, is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact the board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10th of 1944. By the way, let me parenthetically inject that that was a meeting at which the plans for taking all of the money out of Germany and occupied Europe to these corporate fronts in neutral countries was put into effect. It was stated at that meeting that the German industrialists would continue to fund the Nazi Party underground, and that the Nazi Party would remain closely allied with these corporations. And in the early part of this description, I actually reproduced Paul Manning's text, in which he quotes from captured documents that were in his possession. So that's the reference to this meeting in August of 44. Continuing now. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Some still envision a Fourth Reich, and then skipping down. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. Quote, all orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And then of the influence of this group, and why people don't hear about this, and part of it, of course, is the ruthlessness of General Müller and whoever his successor would be. The conclusion of this description, and again, taking directly from Paul Manning's text, speaking of Martin Bormann, were he to emerge, it would embarrass the governments that assisted in his escape, the industrial and financial leaders who benefited from his acumen and transferred their capital to neutral nations in the closing days of World War II, and the businessmen of four continents who profited from the 750 corporations he established throughout the world as depositories of money, patents, bearer bonds, and shares in the blue-chip industries of the United States and Europe. When I penetrated the silence cloaking this story, after countless interviews and laborious research in German and American archives for revealing documents of World War II, I knew that the Bormann saga of flight capital and his escape to South America was really true. It had been covered up by an unparalleled manipulation of public opinion and the media. The closer I got to the truth, the more quiet attention I received from those forces surrounding and protecting Martin Bormann, and also from those who had a direct interest in halting my investigation. Over the period of years it took to research this book, I was the object of diligent observation by squads of Gestapo agents dispatched from South America by General Gestapo Müller, who directs all security matters for Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, and his organization, the most remarkable business group anywhere in the secret world of today. Müller's interest in me, an American journalist, confirmed the truth of my many interviews and my ongoing investigation. There are also those in international government and business who have attempted to stop my forward movement on this investigation. In Germany, France, England, and the United States, too many leaders in government and finance still adhere to Winston Churchill's statement to his cabinet in 1943, quote, in wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies, unquote. Oddly, I encountered less resistance from Martin Bormann and his aging peers than I did from the cover-up groups in West Germany, Paris, London, Washington, and Wall Street. And that, again, from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It was published in 1981 and authored by the heroic Paul Manning. And that's available on the website, and it's there for free and for the use of any member of the listening audience who wants to take advantage of this. And so we can move forward from this point. Now we can talk about fascism. We can talk about September 11th. I can continue to talk about the Bormann Group. When one thinks about it, just simply think about the powerful names, not only in American finance and industry, but to think about Volkswagen, Daimler Chrysler, as it's now called. It's no longer Daimler Benz.
And certainly many of our major food chains are German-owned. The Germans are moving into this country. In fact, I hear even in the area where we live, why a German corporation came in and bought up all of the water companies here up in Felton.
Correct.
And, of course, they're coming in with massive amounts of their money, and they're buying America. And, of course, where is the outcry? Well, my goodness, you know, it's a free world. I mean, where are they getting the money? We're giving it to them with a massive trade deficit. The trade deficit for the first 8 months of this year was $286 billion. That trade deficit, we're talking that it's going to be close to $500 billion trade deficit this year. Where is the money going? Communist China, Japan, Germany. And then, of course, it will come in here to buy up America.
Yes, indeed. A couple thoughts here, Dr. Stan. Let's scroll up on the Spitfire List website, spitfirelist.com, and open up FTR 268. FTR 268, Americans thought they were free. And this is a program that recorded just after George Bush assumed office in January of 2001. In fact, this might even have been after he was basically appointed president when they stopped the Florida recount. But one of the things people wonder about fascism, and, you know, what is fascism? And it's not something that people hear a lot about. The term was actually coined by Benito Mussolini, the world's first doctrinaire fascist. And Mussolini, who was capitalized, by the way, largely by the same American corporations that capitalized Hitler and fascist Japan, Mussolini was asked by journalists what fascism was, how he would define it, and he gave two one-word definitions. He said, fascism is reaction, and he said, fascism is corporatism. And what he meant by that was, basically, to make a long story short, in the United States, our government is supposed to be of the people, by the people, for the people. But fascism is a corporate state, and that's how Mussolini defined it. It's basically of the people, by the fascists, for the corporations. When this is a bit of an oversimplification, when people are at work and their boss tells them to do something, they don't say, well, let's vote on it. And democracy has nothing to do with it. I mean, hopefully if you've got a smart boss, he or she takes into account the needs of the people who are working there, as well as obviously the overall management perspective. But the point is that democracy doesn't have anything to do with it. And what Mussolini believed, to make a long story short, was that a country should be set up along the lines of power distribution in a corporation. Basically, your boss tells you to do something, and you say, okay. Now, again, let's turn to spitfirelist.com. Let's open up the description for FTR 268, Americans Thought They Were Free. And I'll just read the first few paragraphs here. This broadcast analyzes the 2000 election, unquote, as a right-wing or fascist coup. President-elect Bush has been said by associates to view his governing style as that of, quote, a sort of corporate board chairman who will set broad goals and trust others to work out the details. That, by the way, from the San Jose Mercury News of January 6th of 2001, an article by Stephen Toma. Bush positions himself as chairman of the board. And then going down to the first numbered paragraph, reprising information first presented in Miscellaneous Archive Show M42, the program highlights the fundamentals of Mussolini's fascist state, characterized by Il Duce himself as the corporate state. What I've got next is a quote of the next couple of paragraphs from the book The Corporate State, which was an English-language edition of Mussolini's speeches on that subject. It was published in English by Velecki Publishing, and copyright 1938 in soft cover. And on page 7 of Mussolini's The Corporate State, authored by Mussolini himself, here's how he defined fascism. So when members of the audience are wondering, well, what does he mean by fascism? What's fascism? I've heard the word. What does it mean? This is from the horse's mouth, so to speak, from Mussolini himself, from his book, The Corporate State. And quoting here in paragraph 1, on the corporate state, resolution drafted by the head of the Italian government and read by him on November 13, 1933, before the Assembly of the National Council of Corporations on the eve of his important speech. quote, "The National Council of Corporations, quote, defines corporations as the instrument under which, under the aegis of the state, carries out the complete, organic, and totalitarian regulation of production with a view to the expansion of the wealth, political power, and well-being of the Italian people." Now, sounds good, but in practice it didn't work that way. In fact, what ultimately happened was that basically the very wealthy got very well-to-do, even more well-to-do, and everybody else basically wound up out of the barn, so to speak. It did not work as an economic program. So, by way of touching bases with some of the root documentation, that I think is a good place to look. People say, well, you know, fascism, I've heard of it. What is it? You know, where does that come from? Well, that's from Mussolini himself. And skipping down in...
Could we possibly get over into your view of the occurrence of September 11th? I think that is certainly such an important issue, and I agree with you. It's important to understand that fascism is really almost a corporate socialism, and by socialism I don't mean the idea of redistributing the wealth and creating a socialist utopia. I mean a system by which the government controls every aspect of life, provides for the health, education, and the welfare of the public, and this is all mediated by corporations that do this to keep the people enslaved. But unfortunately, when the government provides for your health, education, and welfare, they can also limit your health, education, and welfare, or use the educational process to get people to go along with their agenda. They can, of course, utilize their health program to benefit themselves, not necessarily you. And the great tragedy of today is this is exactly the direction America is headed, where everything is mediated out of the central authority in Washington, D.C., in total conflict with the Constitution, which was aimed at limiting the power of the central government, because the men who founded America didn't believe you couldn't trust anybody with power. Power was corrupting, and of course, as Lord Acton had said so well, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and of course, as a friend of mine added, absolutely everyone. And so this is where we are today. But let's probably get into your thoughts. I'd like to get your thoughts on what happened on September 11th. What is the significance of that event, and how did it come about? How could the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Central Intelligence Agency have had made such a terrible, terrible mistake?
What I think happened on September 11th was a continuation of the Second World War. And what I believe September 11th really was an act of war by the Underground Reich against the United States and an attempt at basically subverting this country and either subjugating it, controlling it economically, or if that should prove to be a failure, to politically subjugate the country under the circumstances. I can appreciate that that would sound like an awfully tall order to try to document in so many words, but what I believe happened was, and let's go back to the events that we were talking about at the end of World War II, what I believe happened was that we hired Bormann and the Underground Reich, and we put together the paperclip scientists and these others. And we also, by the way, utilized some networks that they had developed in the Middle East, in particular some of the elements around the Wahhabi sect in Saudi Arabia, and another organization that one hears very little about, but that is very, very important, something called the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood was allied with Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy in World War II, and it's sort of the granddaddy organization of all of the Islamic fundamentalist and militant Islamic organizations today, including Al-Qaeda. When on November 11th of 2001, the Treasury Department froze the assets of a number of different terrorists supporting individuals and institutions, one of the most interesting and substantively important, I believe, was an organization called Al-Taqwa, that's spelled capital A-L, capital T-A-Q-W-A, and also a fellow named Youssef Nada. Yusef Nada was the head of the bank Al-Taqwa, and an associate of his and a director of Al-Taqwa named Ahmed Huber. That's him, H-U-B-E-R. He was originally a Swiss citizen of German extraction, but he converted to Islam in the 1950s. And what I believe took place on September 11th was that the elements which we had been nurturing during the course of the Cold War, and the elements that we thought we could put together as vehicles, meaning we, now I'm using the term we, meaning the United States, okay, presumably we're all American citizens, or at least, you know, resident aliens who support the basic system of constitutional government. So when I use the term we, I mean the United States. Okay, I'm using that term generally. I believe the United States put elements to work during the Cold War for it that were, in fact, elements of a Third Reich gone underground and that absolutely intended to use the power that they accrued during the Cold War to ultimately either destroy or subjugate the United States, either to destroy it physically through terrorist acts, or to destroy it or subjugate it economically. And ultimately, economic subjugation leads automatically to political control. And what I think took place on September 11th was an attack by the underground Reich in which Islamic fundamentalists who had been originally used by the U.S. during the closing phase of the Cold War, the Al-Qaeda terrorists, the Al-Qaeda forces, which grew out of the resistance to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1980, those elements, which had been nurtured at one level by elements of U.S. intelligence, but at another, more profound level by Nazi Germany, attacked the United States. And I believe that one of the important things to understand about fascist methodology is that it utilizes a fifth column that basically is sympathetic to the aims of the fascist attacker in order to subvert the country that is under attack. Now, this is, I'm summing up a lot of things that will maybe seem crazy to some members of the audience. I can appreciate that. I put together as much of the documentation as one could hope to do.
All right, now, are you suggesting then that there was foreknowledge on the part of some people in government that, of course, allowed this to happen? Are you suggesting that there were people in government that encouraged it to happen? Are you suggesting that this is an effort on the part of this Nazi or Third Reich element, of course, to undermine the fabric of society? And, of course, there is nothing that we could have done about it because we had no idea it was coming.
Well, I would suggest that there were elements of all of the things that you've said involved.
All of the above, huh?
Well, there was a fifth column element that did know. See, one of the problems in terms of simply the psycholinguistics of this is when we send we or they. I think when one talks about the CIA or the FBI or the military, one should understand that the vast majority of the people, in my opinion, within all of those institutions are fair and honorable people and are sincerely patriotic. Yet at the same time, all of those institutions necessarily have to take into account the political and economic relationships that govern this country and this world. For example, the late John O'Neill, who was in charge of the FBI's investigation into Al-Qaeda, resigned from his position in disgust because, as he told a number of journalistic sources, basically the secrets to Al-Qaeda and their attacks on the United States are to be found in Saudi Arabia, but that his investigation had been deliberately frustrated by profound corporate connections to Saudi Arabia and the business connections and the political connections that stemmed from that. Now, the younger George Bush, I should say, had his first oil company, Arbusto Energy, capitalized in part, in all probability, by the Bin Laden family. George W. Bush's first oil company was Arbusto Energy. It was put together by a guy named James R. Bath, who in turn had very strong connections to the Saudi elite. He was the North American business representative for both the Bin Laden family. Bin Ladens are kind of like the Rockefellers of Saudi Arabia. They are a very, very powerful family. their connections come from having built many of the key construction contracts in Saudi Arabia, not only the facilities around Mecca and Medina, the two holiest sites in Islam, but other facilities in the Saudi kingdom. And this actually goes back to the business relationships that I discussed early on in the program when I made what I hope was not a too confusing diversion from discussion of, or not a diversion, but a digression to a discussion of Alan Dulles and Jack Philby and King Ibn Saud. One of King Ibn Saud, he was the founder of Saudi Arabia. One of his good friends was Mohammed bin Laden, the father of Osama bin Laden. And the Saudi bin Laden Group, the parent company of the Saudi economic empire, was actually put together in 1931. It predates Saudi Arabia per se by a full year. But through his relationship with King Ibn Saud, who in turn was tied into Alan Dulles in a very significant way, who in turn was tied in with the Bush family and their investments in Nazi Germany, Mohammed bin Laden put together a very, very lucrative construction business. He had many sons and daughters, and one of his sons was Osama bin Laden. He was very powerful, basically the heir, one of many heirs, to a very, very powerful economic organization. And in turn, another of the powerful Saudi families, the bin Mahfouz family, one of whose members, Khalid bin Mahfouz, was the head of the Saudi National Central Bank. These two families had as their business representative James R. Bath, who in turn put forth some of the venture capital to start Arbusto Energy on behalf of the Bush family. And people who knew James R. Bath at the time, and by the way, James Bath claimed to have been working for the CIA, having been recruited by the elder George Bush when he was director of that agency. You know, when we're talking about a lot of these things, sometimes it's good to remember as a shorthand that FBI headquarters is named for J. Edgar Hoover, CIA headquarters is named for George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st President of the United States. So one always wants to remember that. But those business connections that we first saw in connection with the development of Saudi Arabia at the end of World War II, we've got Alan Dulles, money mover extraordinaire, as you noted, Dr. Stan, an espionage agent of the First Order, head of the OSS office in Bern, Switzerland, helping to set up Saudi Arabia. We've later got the modern Saudi state, which perhaps is an oxymoron given some of the proclivities of that country, but we've got the modern Saudi state, which for our practical purposes has a quarter of the world's proven petroleum reserves. Beyond that, Saudi Arabia has reserves that are very easy to develop economically, so it's actually cheaper to come up with a barrel of oil from Saudi Arabia than to produce a barrel from someplace else, so it makes it more profitable for the major oil companies to sell Saudi oil, the preferred brand being something called Saudi Light. It's a very light crude which has fewer impurities, therefore it's easier to refine, it's lighter to ship, and makes more profits at the pump, but none of the consumers get a break. In other words, you don't pull up to a gas pump and say, hey, fill her up with Saudi Light. You don't get a break at the gas pump. But these same types of relationships have moved forward into the present period. George Bush's first energy company, in all probability, capitalized in part by the bin Laden families and the bin Laden family and the Bush family. James R. Bath, as I was starting to say, was stated by people who knew him at the time to have no money of his own, practically. So in all probability, the money for George Bush's first oil company came in part from the family of Osama bin Laden. If we open up a file, and I'm going to ask listeners to go back to For the Record, the SpitfireList.com, let's scroll up to For the Record 356, Mein Jihad, Part 4. And we'll take a look at some interesting connections that date back to World War II and that stretch forward into the present time, in which I think mirror some of the events at the end of World War II and some of the very complex events that overtook this country on September 11th. Because in relation to the questions you asked, Stan, some of all of the above, I think there were elements in the country that knew in advance and elements that deliberately subverted the potential response that we undertook in connection to September 11th. And I would submit that there are also a lot of people within the intelligence community and the military and hopefully around the country that are sincerely resistant to these realities and who will put up some resistance and perhaps...
We're going to have to just wait just a moment here and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and of course we're getting his view of what happened on September 11th. And as he said, he thinks that there were people there, good people who are very concerned about what happened. There were people who anticipated what was going to happen. There were people who hoped to be able to utilize this for their own purposes. You pick up the story from there, David.
All righty. Well, let's go to the SpitfireList.com website, and let's open up, for the record, 356. Now, it's titled Mind Jihad, Part 4, The Jihad for Freedom. Now, what that is a reference to an element I think that Dr. Stan, and when you talk about, and you hit the nail on the head in discussing the importation of many of these Nazis at the end of World War II, not only the paperclip scientists, but also the Reinhard Gehlen spy people, and this entire Nazi intelligence apparatus, which we then installed as our eyes and ears on the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in World War II. In 1948, many of these same power brokers, including Alan Dulles and his business associate, Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of the current seated president of the United States, they took a look at the defeat of Thomas Dewey in 1948 by Harry Truman, and it was one of those things that wasn't supposed to happen. So they attributed Harry Truman's success in part to his support for Israel, and so they became very alarmed that there was too much Jewish, unquote, support for Harry Truman. So what they undertook to do was to bring in many of these Nazi elements that we've spoken about and to actually install them in the United States as key leaders in many of the Eastern European ethnic communities that were very strong in many of the cities in the industrial Northeast and Midwest, the so-called Rust Belt, as it came to be called. Many of these cities had very large Eastern European emigre groups, and those had traditionally been Roosevelt New Deal voters. And we should remember, when we look at the Third Reich, that many of the elements that were associated with the Third Reich were actually Central and Eastern European fascists from places like Bulgaria, the Ukraine, the Baltic states, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Croatia, Albania, the Baltic states, and for a time the Ukraine were all allied with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, the common goal being basically to defeat communism. Well, at the end of World War II, Alan Dulles, and there's that name again, set up a program called the Crusade for Freedom. Under this program, thousands of Central and Eastern European Nazi collaborators, including war criminals of the First Order, entire Waffen-SS units, entire SS intelligence units, I should say, were brought into the United States, and they were installed as key leaders in Eastern European ethnic communities and also as key Republican Party functionaries in order basically to promote anti-communism abroad and anti-Semitism and pro-Republican political sentiment at home. Now, the guy who oversaw this was Alan Dulles. The guy who managed the program for Alan Dulles was a young lawyer from Southern California named Richard Nixon, who, of course, went on to become vice president and later president. The person who fronted for this crusade for freedom was Ronald Reagan, a young actor from Southern California, and the guy who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people into the United States was William Casey, the director of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, and later head of the CIA. So these are names which, again, we're going way back in time, and we're taking a look at events that took place at the end of World War II. But if we look forward from that time, we're seeing names that have dominated American politics today. Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, William Casey is not as well known, but when one looks, for example, at the importation of cocaine and other drugs by elements of the CIA in the 1980s, that was undertaken by William Casey's CIA. This resulted in the actual, not only the importation of many of these Nazi and fascist collaborators, and including one entire Belarusian SS unit, the Vorkommando Moscow, was settled complete and intact in the New York, New Jersey area in order to counteract the large Jewish voting blocks which existed in those areas. Now, one of the things that I've hypothesized about Stan, one of the hunches I have, is that during the closing phase of the Cold War, in which one of the things that ultimately brought the Soviets to their knees was the invasion of Afghanistan, and the mobilization of the world's Muslim community on behalf of the anti-Soviet effort in Afghanistan ultimately led to a similar use of Islamofascists, and there's a term I haven't used to this point, but Islamofascists, basically doctrinaire fascists, but ones who are using a perverted form of Islam in order to further their political ends. And I think there is substantive evidence that during the closing phase of the Cold War, something very similar took place to the Crusade for Freedom. I think many of these same types of Nazi and fascist elements, but again, going back to the Middle East, Islamofascist elements were brought into the United States to help to recruit for the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, and also to help to finance very conservative political beliefs in the United States. And in turn, there is a major link up between the Republican Party and between elements that were arrested, or elements that were raided on March 20th of 2002 by the Justice and Treasury Departments as part of something called Operation Green Quest. Now, in For the Record 356, and again, if we open this file, you can see some excerpts from mainstream papers, and in some cases very conservative papers, talking about the actual links between the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, the same branch of the Republican Party that grew out of this, completely illegal, by the way. The Crusade for Freedom was a completely illegal operation. It was a joint CIA and State Department operation conducted in the United States, which was completely against the CIA's charter. So it was an illegal operation, and it resulted ultimately in these Nazi and fascist elements being installed as a branch of the Republican Party. This, they were made permanent in 1973 when the elder George Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee.
Well, let me ask you, David, but you exclude the fact that these same forces work within the Democrat Party as well. In other words, is this just simply Republicans, or is this a situation of bipartisan treason?
I think that there are certainly elements, particularly one of the things that's interesting about the Republican and Democratic Party is that in the Democratic Party, the elements that you will see aligned with some of these same elements tend to be from the left of the Democratic Party. But in the Republicans, it tends to be the more right-wing branch of the Republican Party. There definitely are individual Democrats that have taken campaign contributions from some of these same elements. I think the degree of institutional connection is considerably different, and that's primarily due to the oil business and due to the other business connections that involve Saudi Arabia. Certainly, the oil, not just the oil wealth of Saudi Arabia itself, but the thing we have to remember, Dr. Stan, is that when we channel all of this money to places like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, by the way, has a tremendous business presence in the West. They're one of the principal stockholders in Daimler Chrysler and many other corporations. Well, it's a tiny, tiny little country, but they're very wealthy because of all of the money that they get from the oil business. And in turn, you were talking about earlier in the program, Stan, about our budget deficits and about trade deficits. Well, that money has been recycled into the United States, and so businesses that are not themselves necessarily directly connected to the oil business have tremendous investment by many of these petrodollar business connections. It's also true in the nonprofit world, too. Nonprofit corporations are funded by the Saudi/Wahhabi/Muslim Brotherhood elements. I think that there is a larger degree of institutional connection with the Republican Party itself. But this is not to say that there are not connections between some of the same Wahhabi elements and more left-leaning political elements in the United States. Some individual Democratic politicians have taken contributions from this same milieu. But one of the interesting things about the Republican and Democratic connections, or between the ideological affiliations, is it tends to be the right wing of the Republican Party that is connected with these same elements. And in the progressive political sector, one tends to find more left-wing elements without playing chicken with a potential lawsuit. Here, Stan, I think that, for example, many of the elements grouped around support for the Palestinian national movement in the United States are themselves very strongly connected to this same milieu. It's one of the things that makes political labeling or ideological labeling a difficult thing to do, and it's one of the reasons, Dr. Stan, that I refer to myself as an anti-fascist, and I refer to my discipline as anti-fascism, because when one is taking a look at some of the traditional political groupings and labelings, it tends to become confusing. The PLO, for example, is financed primarily by Saudi Arabia, so that some of the same connections which one will see in the United States, and these tend to be left political elements, supportive of the Palestinian cause, these are also, the funding conduits that support them are also elements that have very strong links with the right wing of the Republican Party.
You know, I think that what we do is to confuse people, and people either want to be the Republicans or the Democrats. I believe the leadership of both of those parties is controlled by essentially the same people. I believe that they're globalists. I believe that they have an allegiance to this whole internationalist system. I think that they are both tied to Saudi Arabia. And, of course, they want us to choose up sides and to spend all our time fighting one another ideologically, whereas, of course, they sit back there, rub their hands together, and say, now, of course, there's no opposition to us. So as long as we get involved in this ideological struggle or in the political struggle, or we think this is a cultural battle, we lose sight of what this is really all about. And my concern is that it's so easy to say, well, it's all the Republicans, or it's all the Democrats, or but it's really the leadership of both of them. I believe we have one political party in the United States that has two branches, but both of them are headed exactly the same direction.
Well, there is an element of truth to that. I would take issue with some aspects of it, but it's one of the problems is it's such a short amount of time to deal with subjects that, in fact, are complex and have to be dealt with at greater length. And I think, in fact, words themselves can be very limiting. When one looks at the world, one wants to look at power. And in the modern world, one of the things that translates directly into power is oil and oil wealth. And one of the things that I think lends an element of truth to what you said, Stan, is that money is, it's not just the root of all evil, it's pretty much the root of just about everything in the modern world. It is impossible to do things past the point without money. And when you've got a lot of money, it'll buy a lot of influence. And I think one of the things that happens with political and social institutions is something I touched on earlier. Once an individual has signed on, whether it's with a corporation, whether it's with the Justice Department, FBI, CIA, the military, whether it's with a journalistic institution, when that person has their life situation caught up with it, when the job that somebody has worked at, and when the job that is paying the house payments, the car payments, getting ready for the kids' college education or whatever, when that job then turns out to be connected to very serious institutional wrongdoing, it presents the individual with a political and I think at a certain point a spiritual dilemma. Does one become self-sacrificing and also perhaps sacrifice the future of one's family in order to do what is right, or does one do what is frankly the easiest thing to do? What does one go along with the program? That's generally how it's put. Do you basically decide that to go along, you have to get along and decide not to talk about these things? But going back and doing again, Dr. Stan, what I think is past a point impossible, to try to relate the things that we've been talking about, and I want to give you a big tip of the hat for being willing to entertain the subject of the Bormann organization and the Underground Reich. This is not something most people will let into the light of day. They don't want to hear about it. Let's take a look in 356, and let's skip down to an article from the Wall Street Journal of April 18th of the year 2002. And this is about former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and the article by Roger Thurow and Glenn R. Simpson. O'Neill met Muslim activists tied to charities. Let me just read a little bit of this and see if this doesn't strike some sparks in the minds of the listening audience. Among the leaders attending the meeting with Paul O'Neill was Talat Otman, a longtime associate and supporter of President Bush's family, who gave a benediction at the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia in August of 2000. But he also serves with Jamal Barzinji, by the way, who's connected to not only Al-Qaeda, or allegedly connected to the funding of Al-Qaeda, but also to the Al-Taqwa organization, which is sort of a Muslim or Islamo-fascist organization. But he also serves with Barzinji on the board of Amana Mutual Funds Trust, an investment firm founded by Y. Yaqub Mirza, the Northern Virginia businessman who set up most of the entities targeted by the Treasury and whose tax records were sought in the raid. That's the March 20th, 2002 raid. And skipping down and from the next paragraph, paragraph 14, quote, "The case also highlights conflicts between the Bush administration's domestic political goals and its war on terror." And this, I think, Stan, this paragraph addresses some of the very large dilemma that you touched on earlier. There are conflicts in many of these relationships, and it's one of the reasons why one doesn't want to oversimplify it, because it's not an easy thing to understand. But let's turn again to paragraph 14. This again from the Wall Street Journal of April 18th, 2002, page A4. I mean, this is from a mainstream, even conservative source. "The case also highlights conflicts between the Bush administration's domestic political goals and its war on terror. GOP officials began courting the U.S. Muslim community intensely in the late 1990s, seeking to add that ethnic bloc to the party's political base." And skipping to the next paragraph, Bruce Zagaris, an asset forfeiture lawyer who represents clients in similar cases, that a meeting between Treasury officials and anyone who might be associated with an entity under investigation is very unusual. Quote, "It's virtually impossible to arrange such a meeting, especially with the Treasury Secretary," Mr. Zagara said. "It's very difficult to get even phone calls returned." And skipping down still more, two nonprofits affiliated with Mr. Mirza were named in the search warrant, the SAR Foundation Incorporated and the Heritage Education Trust Incorporated, held large blocks of shares in Amana's mutual funds in 1997, according to SEC records. The SEC documents and other records detailing connections between Mr. Otman and the Islamic Institute, on the board of which Mr. Otman serves, and the raided groups were compiled by the National Security News Service, a Washington-based nonprofit research group. And then just a couple of more paragraphs here. Now, Talat Otman is a good friend and a former director of Harkin Energy. Mr. Otman also was on the board of Mr. Safouri's and Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute, the GOP-leaning group that received $20,000 from the Safa Trust, one of the raid's targets. The president of the Safa Trust, Jamal Barzinji, is a former business associate of Switzerland-based investor Youssef Nada, whose assets were frozen last fall after the Treasury designated him a person suspected of giving aid to terrorists. Mr. Otman has ties to the Bush family going back to the 1980s, when he served with George W. Bush on the board of a Texas petroleum firm, Harkin Oil and Gas Incorporated. Mr. Otman had visited the White House during the administrations of both President Bush and his father, George H.W. Bush. Program goes on to discuss other of those connections, but to again try to attempt the impossible here, Dr. Stan, and I very much appreciate your indulgence under the circumstances, and I again invite you, if I'm ranging too far afield here, try to kind of pull me back within a context that would be easier for your listeners to deal with. But I want to call attention to this website and to the documentation on it. Not only because I work real hard, frankly, and I don't get paid for it, but the information is there. Now, what you've got in that, and this didn't receive much publicity, but it's from a major article in the Wall Street Journal, is you've got a director of Harkin Energy. You've got a guy who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000, a close business associate and political associate of both Georges Bush, interceding with the Treasury Department on behalf of individuals who had had records seized and on organizations as major funders of Al-Qaeda and Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and others. And one of the things that makes, I think, the dealing with some of the events of September 11th difficult is that the names are not names that are well known. For example, if I talk about Youssef Nada, or if I talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, these just aren't names that have a lot of recognition.
Well, I think our listeners certainly are well acquainted, at least with the Muslim Brotherhood, originated in 1928. And we've talked, you know, a great deal about the background of this whole Wahhabi movement, which interlocks more or less with the Muslim Brotherhood. Your point, of course, about the relationship between the Bush family and the Saudis, it is not simply by coincidence that there is a 600 families are today suing the Saudi princes, one or two of them, for funding Al-Qaeda. They have a $1 trillion lawsuit against Saudi Arabia and these Saudi princes for suing, for financing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, both before September 11th and after September 11th. And, of course, the Bush administration has done everything they could to block the suit. And who is it, of course, what law firm is defending the Saudi princes against the suit? Why, it happens to be the law firm of James Baker III. It's not simply by coincidence. The president's lawyer's law firm is defending the Saudi princes against this suit. So we begin to see this incest this interrelationship between all of these forces. And the question is, what motivates them all? Is it power? Or is there another invisible force behind the scene that is little understood? I'm just going to say, if we've had a couple of people called in earlier, they wanted to ask questions. And at this point, we're just about to the end of the program. Would you mind asking, answering some questions?
Not at all.
So
Dr. Stan,
if Mike or the others are out there and you have a question you'd like to ask, why, you don't have to be bashful. Mike had called in earlier and asked about the relationship between Alan Dulles and Dr. Cameron, who was head of the American Psychiatric Association, who was involved in some grotesque and really totally immoral experimental studies on his patients at the behest of the CIA.
This is Dr. Ewan Cameron?
Yes, Ewan Cameron. Yes. Do you know anything at all about him?
Yes, I do. I don't know of any direct relationship between Alan Dulles and Ewan Cameron. There may very well have been some. Certainly one can say that the period under which, or in which, the experiments under MKUltra and the other CIA mind-controlled experiments took place was when Alan Dulles was head of the CIA and when many of these same relationships were being parlayed into operational relationships within the U.S. One wants to remember when Eisenhower was elected president, well, Richard Nixon was his vice president. He, in turn, was a protege of Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles became director of the CIA. His brother, John Foster Dulles, one of his partners in Sullivan and Cromwell, became Secretary of State. And one of the Dulles brothers' proteges, a guy named Frank Wisner, who in turn had been a lawyer with Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, another of the very important Wall Street law firms. At the same time as Frank Wisner was deputy director of CIA, another Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn partner, Harding Jackson, was another deputy director of CIA. So some of these powerful Wall Street law firms are very important in understanding a lot of these relationships. Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn was the law firm that handled the legal work for the Dow Jones Corporation, the New York Stock Exchange. By the way, there's a really good book talking about that. It's just been reissued. It came out in the early 90s. It's called The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. It's authored by Burton Hirsch. I don't recall who the new paperback edition is by, but that's a good, give people a real good understanding of some of these major Wall Street law firms and how they in turn intersect with the OSS and with the formation of the CIA. Now, Ewan Cameron, again, his work was undertaken with in a time period when Alan Dulles was the primary force in the CIA, and beyond that, when the forces of which Alan Dulles was a part were in absolutely unchallenged direction of the country's affairs. So I am not aware of any direct connection between Ewan Cameron and Alan Dulles. It wouldn't surprise me one bit if there was such a connection, but certainly what Dr. Cameron undertook to do and the horrors that he visited on people took place when Alan Dulles was head of the CIA and when, in turn, Alan Dulles was a prime mover in helping to get things like that underway.
And this is Leah. This is covering the book we carry called Bluebird. We think it's very, very important. Operation Bluebird was an outgrowth of MKUltra and Artichoke and some of these others. Bizarre names that were used because, of course, the last thing they wanted was for the American people to know that they were doing human experimentation on the American people. The scientists had been hired without contracts, of course, because they were frightened to death that people would find out the terrible, terrible things they were doing, actually trying to create sickness in normal people and trying to wipe out their memories, create dissociative personalities. I mean, some of the most bizarre things that have ever happened during this time of our history. And the fact that most people have never heard of this or Operation Bluebird or Artichoke or even of MKUltra is just simply a reflection of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. Well, we're just about out of time. David, what would your parting thoughts like be for our listeners tonight?
Well, for one thing, if people are going to be in the Santa Cruz area, I will be speaking tomorrow night. It's all Q&A, so we will be able to take some questions and answers tomorrow at the Loudon Nelson Community Center at Center Street in Santa Cruz. That's going to begin at 7 p.m. So if there are listeners whose interest has been whetted or piqued and would like to carry on the discussion, I will be hosting a Q&A session at the Loudon Nelson Community Center in Santa Cruz. But beyond that, and far more importantly, Dr. Stan, I want to encourage people to basically roll up their sleeves and to dig into the documentation that's available, the documentation from your website, the documentation from books that are cited there. And I want to make an open invitation to you, Dr. Stan, and to any member of your listening audience to use the documentation, and again, this is not to seem self-righteous, but that I've worked very hard at reproducing with no pay from this website, and to in turn use the material on the printed website and also some audio files that are available on Real Audio that are linked to these descriptions, and basically use the information, disseminate it as far and wide as possible. And I think in terms of a parting comment, Dr. Stan, one of the things that I think is easy to do when one is looking at a body of information like this, one, it's easy to become confused, and I once again want to thank you and tip my hat to you for being willing to wrestle with an intellectual subject that just isn't readily graspable by an awful lot of people, simply because the names are different, the realities have been hidden from people, but even more importantly, the names just aren't household words. And I want to encourage people not to get discouraged by the foreign-sounding names and by the seemingly hopelessly complex tangle of events, and also don't get discouraged by the evil that is inherent in these things, because ultimately I think we have no choice. I don't think we have any choice as living human beings, and I don't think we have a choice, and I don't think we will be accorded a choice by the generations that are going to come after us, and that are going to be asking the question, if not directly, of those of us who are here, then indirectly, what did you do about it?
Well, we're going to have to let you go with that thought, and of course I hope other people would accept the challenge. Dave, thanks so much. It's been a fascinating time. Really appreciate you being with us.
Thanks so much, Dr. Stan.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
And so Monday, may the Lord be with you.